So, Mary, it's a great pleasure to have the opportunity and honour to be able to talk to you. Can you tell me where and when you were born?
I was born in San Remo, Italy. And we stayed there 3 weeks, so I never learnt Italian.
Which year was that?
1921.
Mm. Why were you born in Italy?
Because my father was working in a member of the Indian Civil Service.
Yeah.
And they had leave home, what they called home leave, every 3 years, which was a very long leave. And then they could come back to Europe. But otherwise, they only had short leaves, which they usually used for going around the east, you know, and staying in the east. Now, when they were married in 1920, and I was born in 21, and they were due for a long leave, that's right. And as it were, it was on their honeymoon, as it were. So that they thought, how lovely, we haven't got a home in England to have a baby in. We'd take her somewhere lovely and beautiful and sunny, like Italy, which they didn't know, and didn't know any Italian. And they found an English nursing home in San Remo. They thought of the flowers associated with San Remo, and that's where I was born.
Mm. What was your father doing in the Indian Civil
War? Oh, yes. But my father?
Your father.
Yes. He was a district officer in Rangoon, and that was it. That should be self-explanatory, but it won't be to this generation, will it?
Just a bit more, yes. What sort of man was he, is the main thing?
Yes.
And what influence did he have on you, really?
A lot, because when my mother died, when I was 12 and Pat was 10, he took us over, and as it were, tried to bring us up. Mm. But we hardly knew him when he took us over, because he'd... He was widowed and very, very grieved and sad, but we had hardly seen him before. We'd been sent home, as was the custom, from the tropics. We were thought to be likely to die, and so we were, without penicillin and the rest. Children went home at the age of 5. And so we were sent to my grandparents, who were young enough to take us on for 7 years. Mm. And that was a very formal upbringing. They were very, very good to us, but my sister certainly feels that we should have had more demonstrative affection and encouragement than we got. But we were sent to boarding school, weekly boarders at first, a convent in Torquay called Studley Knoll, Les Filles la Croix, and French nuns. And then when my mother died, before she died, she took us over to Roehampton, which was the Sacred Heart Convent, where she had been brought up, and her cousins. So in a sense, it was a sort of family connection. And she handed us over, knowing that she was dying. So of course, we were got special attention there from the nuns all the time. So naturally, I was very happy there as a school. A very good school, too, I think.
You talked about the hierarchical influence, both of your grandparents' home and of the convent.
Yes.
What did you mean by that, really?
Well, I mean by hierarchy what Louis Dumont meant about hierarchy when he wrote about India. It's a balanced rational system. It's meant to be a balanced rational system, let's say. And it's very close to the concept of hierarchy in mathematics. So that it means order. And ours was a very orderly upbringing. And it means fairness and balance, particularly. Nowadays in English language, especially in America, hierarchy just means an up-down, single direction relationship in which all the orders come from above and those below are subalterns that they obey. But that's not the original idea of hierarchy. The hierarchy was balanced as between Pope and Emperor, as Dumont points out so well, and different balances between the castes, in the sense that the first shall be last, or the Pope is the servants of the servants of God. That kind of balancing and closure of the system is what I'm thinking of when I talk about hierarchy. And rational in the sense that there will always be a patterned reason for something. So if at bedtime, it's a question of who goes to bed first, obviously it's the youngest, because that's a deprivation to go to bed first. The eldest has the benefit of staying up. We always had to share everything because we were just by ourselves. We were very dependent on each other. And so that's why I like the idea of hierarchy. I find it something sensible that you can reason about and reassuring. It's non-arbitrary.
Returning to your parents, did you ever feel that by being sent home, somehow this indicated some lack of affection or love towards you or not?
No, I never did. No, I don't think either of us did. It was so much, so natural. So of all our friends were being sent home. Mm. There was one I remember her name even, who was allowed to stay till she was 7. That was thought to be terribly dangerous. Mm. So it was so much the rule. There's a very good book about it, Charles Allen, called The Children of the Raj, I think, yes. And it says how much it grieved the parents and how much it was absolutely obligatory. You're thought to be playing with your children's lives if you kept them.
Mm. Well, to return to the convent, were you very consciously religious before you went to it, or did it instill an interest in...
I think a bit of both. Let me just think. Oh, yes, we were consciously religious because our family at my grandparents' home was what's called in Catholic circles a mixed marriage. So my grandmother, who was really close to us, much closer than the grandfather, she was a Protestant and a very staunch Protestant. But she had promised her daughter that she'd bring us up as Catholics. And so it's her duty, and so she did it as a duty. And so we were driven to Mass every week by my grandfather. And we were taught the catechism by my grandmother, but that was about it until we went to the first convent. And there, that was very sectarian attitude to Anglicans and to foreigners. No, not to foreigners, because they were all Catholics, but to agnostics and atheists. Yeah, so that we did have a very sectarian upbringing before I went to the convent at 12 years old.
And what was the influence of the convent then? Did it just reinforce your belief in Catholicism?
Absolutely, but it didn't. It was much more open-minded than the first school, you see. Mm. Much more generous, although I think there was a good deal of sectarianism there still. Have you read Richard Griffith's book called The Reactionary Revolution? It's about French Catholicism after 1870, the 40s, 50s, I think that's the dates. And it sort of goes to town about the sectarianism of a certain brand of Catholicism that was being taught, meaning particularly attacking the nearest denomination, that would be the Church of England in our case, you see, and the Protestants in France. So that we had a lot of loyalty built in and instilled into us from the start. Yeah. Is that what you meant?
Mm.
But also a love of the Church itself.
Well, two very important questions come out of this. One is, you say that in a way that time in the convent set the problems for much of your later anthropology. What exactly did you mean by that?
Oh, I can't. I think I'd have to have time to think about what I meant then. Mm. I said that quite recently, didn't I?
Yes.
And
yes.
No clue there what I could have meant.
Well, I think it was this hierarchy and order.
Yes, it is. Oh, yes. Mm. And therefore my interest in comparisons of culture.
Yes.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The second question is, I know that at one point in your life, a lot of people said to you, how can you be both an anthropologist and a Catholic? To which you replied with the famous story about Evans Pritchard and so on. But it has always puzzled me too.
I know. Does it really?
In one way.
Seriously?
I mean, I know that...
I think it's a terrible ignorance on their part.
Well, I know that most, as Evans Pritchard, actually, at the end of that story, which you print, Evans Pritchard told me the punchline, which you don't print, which is that...
Which is the story?
Well, the story is that, which you tell very nicely, he told you that when he asked Hutton whether he would support Forsyth.
Yeah.
And he said, no Jews, no women, no Catholics.
Yes.
And then Heimendorf, oh, well, he's Austrian. But then Evans Pritchard said to Hutton, Well, I'm sorry, you're going to have either a Jew or a Catholic, because all the great anthropologists are either Catholic or Jewish. Now,
I've forgotten that.
I sort of understand what he meant. But
at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there is, for some people, there's a puzzle, because if you take the Durkheimian view, and if you are culturally relativist and you look at other religions, some people say that logically shouldn't that undermine your belief in your Catholicism?
Yes, I can only think of that as an extraordinarily ignorant question. If you excuse me.
Yes, yes. But
you said I could say what I like.
Yes.
Because this is due to these nuns, the convent, the first convent. Mm. They dealt with it all the time. I mean, they assumed that there would be other religions and that everybody had the right, not everybody had the right, but everybody would think of God and everybody would make God in their own image, as it were, rather than the other way around. And every religion would be bound to be different. So that I had been so inured to that idea that I didn't see that anthropology posed a particular problem about it. So what kind of... when I say sectarian, I might be sounding self-contradictory there, because the sectarians think everybody else is wrong. That's the meaning of the word, modern meaning of the word. And they could think that they were wrong without thinking that, and that they were right, without being troubled about their rightness. Mm. I don't see the problem at all. What's his name? Daryl Ford did that.
I told you. That's right.
And I told you about Helen Spur. Mm. Did I?
No. Tell us that.
What's her name? Helen Spurway. Mm. She was a very fine biologist in University College. And she came to me one day and said, you're an anthropologist, I want to talk to one. Shall we have lunch together? So I hardly knew her. So we went off. She was very close to Haldane, who was there then. And we talked. She said, I'm very interested in virgin birth. And the reason that she was interested in it was because she had a big Darwinian biological, evolutionary theory about parthenogenesis. And that she was working out a scheme. I don't know how it stands, and I probably got it wrong, but as far as I understood, she thought that in any species, this is about speciation, there would be a possibility of virgin births, of no male intervention and a female conceiving, or the other way around, in so many thousands of generations.
I see.
I hope I've got it right.
Yes.
And so to work on it, she kept her guppies, these little tiny fish that are especially convenient because they fit into it, lots of them can fit into a jam jar or a single one. But they can, but they're sexually, physically very highly differentiated. And so she kept each guppy was in a separate jam jar from spawn. So they had never, ever had sexual intercourse. And she used to go home every evening and see how they were getting on and change the water or fill up again, And one evening she went to the guppies, and behold, one had spawned. And she published this in the Nature as an important, in a letter to get it quick. And immediately she got a terrific, the Times took it up. And it made the headlines everywhere. That virgin birth, scientists in University College discovers a case of virgin birth. See? And she told me at the same lunch that she'd had wonderful fan mail, that clergymen had written to her to say, you have saved my faith. And girls had written to her to say, I told my mother and she wouldn't believe me. And so she said, so you as an anthropologist can tell me about it. Well, at that time, the anthropologists were having one of their very best arguments about virgin births, and there were brilliant articles about it from Edmund Leach and everybody who, Trowbridge and Islanders and others who thought that the male contribution, people who thought that the male contribution wasn't relevant. See?
Yes.
Fascinating. We won't go on too long about it, but When I told her that I was particularly interested because I was a Catholic, she said, "What?" And she put down her knife and fork and stared at me and said, "What?" "Yes," I said. She said, "Well, in this day and age, in this place, in this college, it makes your mouth go dry." I think that's the best story.
Well, that is very nice. Mm. Well, we'll possibly come back to it, but just the last question about the convent, really. Was there any particular teacher or nun there who deeply influenced you? And secondly, what subjects were you really enjoying most when you were at that
yes.
stage?
Let me say that they were not interested, as you saw I'd written, particularly, they were very interested in getting us married, and they weren't interested in us getting academic qualifications, but in order to get a grant, they had to come up to certain educational standards and be certificated as a teaching school. So that in fact, they were brilliant, not just one. I had a series of really brilliant women teachers. Mother Maud, for instance, they'd all been to Oxford, they'd all done Oxford degrees. But Mother Maud had won the Chancellor's Essay Prize for an essay on 18th century coffee houses. So I was taught by her Latin. Mother Ward, they were called Mother, because they were, oh, okay, that's another story. And Mother Shepherd, those three women were quite outstanding intellectuals as well as teachers and great exemplars for nuns. See. So I can't say there was one who particularly influenced me, but to stand up to to rise up to their standards was quite a challenge. Mm. And that was it, I think. Every day we had what was called a doctrine class. And Peter Frau is especially interested in the gloves story.
Mm, tell the
gloves. Well, we had a school uniform, but in order to go to chapel, we stood in line according to our height and wore gloves. They were brown, little brown cotton gloves. This was out of respect for the church, for the chapel, and the Blessed Sacrament there. And on big feast days, which were great holidays, we would wear white, and of course we had to have white gloves. This amused him a lot, you see. Lots of other ways in which they marked feast days. Feast days were holy days for special saints, you see. Food was different on those days, better. And the gloves were different. But wearing gloves at all was a mark of great deference.
You talk about the gloves quite often. What is the meaning of wearing gloves then?
It's just a meaning of respect. Oh yes, I was going to tell you the doctrine class, we wore gloves for doctrine. Mm. That you brought me back to my point. Mm. So that just for going to the lessons about the church and about religion, which were once a week, we all wore gloves. We sat we went to a different room, a great big sort of hall, and we sat in a ring of chairs arranged around the teaching nun. And we loved those lessons because the nun was so enthusiastic, so absolutely happy to be teaching it, so we all enjoyed it. That's probably the biggest influence.
Mm. And was there any subject?
My subjects, yes. Mm. Oh, English. Mm. I won the school essay prize. Mm. 1 year. I didn't like history. The school was particularly good at history, and I couldn't do maths or science. So it had to be, but I particularly wanted to do social studies because in their wisdom, the Catholic diocese hierarchy, that's to say the bishops, had ordained that all Catholic schools should do a course and take a certificate in Catholic social teaching. And this was based on the papal encyclicals on the just wage and the living wage and such like, called by their Latin names, which of course I remember because they were very influential for me. De Rerum Novarum, first one, new things. And it's about thinking about responsibilities of the employer towards the employed and of the just wage. And the other one was called Rerum Novarum. No, that was Rerum Novarum, and the next one was Quadragesima Anno, 40 years afterwards. Mm. And so we were brought up to date in all sorts of Catholic thinking about individuals. But I really wanted to go on with that subject when I got to university, and the nearest, I should have done sociology. But the nuns, for the reasons which I mentioned about university college just now.
Can you say it again?
Well, university college wasn't allowed to have a sociology department when it was founded, on the theory that sociology just meant teaching socialism and revolution. And the nuns also thought that sociology meant teaching, was anti-God and anti-religion. So they would never have sent me to the LSE, or to do, which is what I wanted to do, mm-hmm. obviously. And but they discovered PPE, which satisfied everybody.
At Oxford?
Yes.
Yes,
where they had a house, and where I stayed.
Did you?
Yes, as a lodger. Yeah, home students, farmers all out to different houses.
So you did PPE at Oxford?
Yes.
Was there anyone there who... whose lectures or...?
Donald McKinnon on philosophy. It was a bad time, it was the war. Everybody really good had gone to, who was young, had gone, and we had an influx of important refugees who taught economics and philosophy, but I can't remember their names, but they were important. Can't remember. But no, not especially. I didn't do well at all in the PPE, but too mathematical. It had just become mathematical, and I really envied the girls who'd had a proper training in maths at their high schools, which we didn't get.
And then you went on into the Colonial Office.
Yes, that was a deliberate choice. Funny, it was a mistake, though. It was the war, and I was wanting to be in it, and involved in action. And I would have done far better to have gone, because it felt quite a... reproach to have been at Oxford and a student during the war. Other girls had brothers who were fighting, or lovers who were fighting, and they felt very bad, and lots of them left. But my father, would be, who was widowed and alone, very lonely, would have been absolutely devastated if I'd given it up. So I had to stay, and when I chose what to do next, we were all mobilised, there wasn't much choice, it was either the civil service or the ATS, or the Wrens.
This was about 43, was it? Or?
Yes, yes. And if I'd known more about life, I would have chosen the Board of Trade, or the Ministry of Supply, or Ministry of Defence, see. But I chose the Colonial Office because of my connection with Burma, through my family, and my connection, and I'd already chosen to do constitutions, colonial constitutions, Westminster Constitution, they were called, as an option in PPE. So I thought that they that fitted together and that I would do the Colonial Office. But the way to choose a real backwater, where nothing was happening during the war, was that.
And you stayed there for how long?
4 years.
4 years.
Yes. Audrey Richards was there.
Was she? Did you meet her there?
Yes. And I met, at a party she gave, I met Bill Stanner, Phyllis Cabry, at Raymond Firth, and Raymond was there, yes. I think Raymond was in the Colonial Office too. Yes, he was, definitely. And he let me, he started me reading, because I started to choose anthropology by then.
What was it, do you think, that, was it the colonial background that made you interested in anthropology?
Yeah, yes, very much, I think, yeah.
As we pass by famous names, occasionally I'll try and get you to linger on them. Audrey, what can you say about Audrey? That
I was really converted by her book, Land, Labour and Doubt. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And I just could, and I compared it at the time with Marjorie Perham, another woman's book at the time, writing about the constitution of Nigeria. And I thought Audrey's work was so much more important and interesting. Wonderful book. Have you read it?
Yes. I read it at the LSE.
Good, of course, yes. And
as a person, did you get to know her?
She was rather scary. She was very sharp, very fierce, very clever, obviously.
Yes, and Raymond?
And Raymond was very charming, and he lent me, or I borrowed, I don't know where I got hold of, We the Tick Appear. And I also read Evans Pritchard's The Newer. And I can say quite, without wishing you to raise it, that I really thought that the Thicker Peer was far too chatty, and what Evans Pritchard used to call the wind among the palm trees kind of anthropology, with Malinowski also. Mm. But I became heir to that feud between the Oxford anthropologists and the LSE, and Malinowski particularly, by preferring Evans Pritchard's book.
Yes. Did you meet Malinowski? He was probably dead.
No, he was dead. He died in 1948, didn't he?
Yes, something like that.
Mm. But the anthropology of my period was absolutely driven by that division. People who'd been in his seminar and people who hadn't. So Dal Ford lost out on that, too.
Which side was he on?
He'd never been in the seminar, so he was out. Mm. Didn't count.
Well, E.P. was in the seminar, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, and he called the other ones bootlickers, and worse, ruder.
Ruder words, yes. Why did he fall out with Malinowski?
He just didn't like him as a person. Mm.
That was the main reason.
Well, he didn't think he had anything, he didn't think of him, he didn't like the Argonauts or the, the Argonauts. Mm. Or the Turbaned Islanders, because he felt it wasn't abstracted enough, it wasn't sociological enough, it was too much what Maffortis used to call the higher journalism. Mm. you've seen that word?
Yes.
You know who?
I didn't know it was Meyer, no.
Yes, well, according to Jack Goody's
book, yes, The Expensive Moment.
No, according to Jack Goody's obituary of Meyer, as he who said it.
Ah, yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So you began to be attracted by Evans Pritchard. Is that why you went to Oxford to do your PhD?
No, it wasn't. I was going to go to Cambridge because Evans Pritchard was at Cambridge.
Ah, yes.
And they hadn't got room. Everybody was rushing to the university after the... And they turned me down. So I wrote to Oxford, and at that point Evans Pritchard got transferred, so I was lucky. Mm. And they said, of course, you're a member. Mm. No problem. Mm. So that was very lucky.
Yes. Yeah. And he became your supervisor?
He was my supervisor, but he handed me on very quickly. Mm. The first thing I had to do was the diploma.
Yes.
With Penniman.
Ah, yes, Tom Penniman.
And then suddenly EP discovered that I didn't have to do it. I could start on a master's degree right away. Mm. So I didn't really do much in the way of going to a few lectures for the diploma, and then I started on a master's, and that was transferred to a PhD. Mm. Now Evans Pritchard was my supervisor, technically, and then he discovered again, because he was new, completely new, that he couldn't supervise PhDs, because he was in a particular kind of chair, which is hard to believe. And he announced this to me with his usual tactless way. When we were queuing for lunch at St. Anthony's, he and Max Glutman and I were in the queue together. And he told me then, in front of Max, that he couldn't supervise me, and who would I like to have? An obvious person was Max, you see. And he had such a reputation, and I'd been so put off by his article on that he wrote against Malinowski, one on culture. Mm. What was it called? I remember it. Mm. And that I really didn't think I would do well with him at all. And I had to make an excuse, why not, because at that stage I think I'd already decided to go to Central Africa. Mm. And he was the only big Central Africanist. It was really awkward. Mm. He was the obvious person. Mm. But John Barnes and who was the one who went to Nuffield?
To Nuffield? Clyde Mitchell.
Clyde.
Yes.
Obviously found it very, very difficult, and other people did, working with him. So they said, well, who would you prefer? So I said, well, I don't think Max is interested in religion.
Yes.
As was true. Hmm. And I don't think I would do really well in that case, because I am. And I'd prefer Srinivas, which is crazy because he's an Indian. Mm. So I was transferred to Srinivas.
And what was he like as a supervisor?
I never saw him. About twice.
Really?
Yes, never saw him after I went to the field.
No. So did you have a local supervisor in the field? Was Audrey out there, or?
No.
So you did your fieldwork more or less unguided?
No, not so. Because of Darryl. How did I get... I did some fieldwork. Oh, Darryl Ford. Mm. At that stage, Darryl Ford was very influential, although he wasn't at Oxford. Mm. He was the head of the African Institute. Mm. This is history. This is important.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the African Institute did several things. They gave a really generous pay to any student that they signed up to write a book in the ethnographic series of Africa. And I had the luck to be allowed to write the one called The Tribes of Lake Nyasa Region, which meant writing about, that's what fits in there, explains why I didn't want to do it with Nigel, with Max. So I wrote the book called Tribes of Lake Nyasa Region, which meant using Max Gluckman, John Barnes, and Clyde Mitchell's work.
Mm.
And that was tremendous education and training. And I got paid enough to help my finances as a student. Mm. We all did. And it meant that we were very indebted to the African Institute. And the African Institute organized our fieldwork. So Darryl was the most important person, apart from E.P. and Maya Fortis, in my life at that stage. And Darryl didn't actually come out to see me, but he wrote me letters like, don't forget to get the ground plan of where people are living and who's related to whom and so on.
Mm.
Yeah.
You must have known him very well because he was at UC.
I did know him very well, yes.
Is there anything you can say about him?
Yes, a lot, I think. Probably he was so good. He was so conscientious and so broad-minded. And he was an intellectual, which I felt Max wasn't, you see.
Mm.
I think that's about it, really. But
he was a good head of department, too, presumably.
Very good, yes. And he kept up with the rest of the university very well. He had a tremendous Cockney accent, which was very endearing, you know, a really strong one. But he was a very loyal friend. And he also brought in foreign anthropologists because African Institute was international.
Mm.
So we had people whose names I would remember but can't for the moment to come and talk to us from Germany or from France.
Mm.
And so in a sense, we felt part of an international subject.
Did you ever have Levi-Strauss?
No.
Did you ever meet him, know him at all?
Yes. Mm. He was invited to come to London. He gave his famous lecture on The Bear and the Barber, and in University College, so Darryl must have invited him.
Mm.
Must have.
Mm.
And he was invited to, we were all invited to a reception at the French Embassy. So we met him there, apart from just saying, how do you do, and things, yes.
That's all you did, really? You didn't really talk to
him? I called on him in Paris when I went later, many years later.
Mm. So returning to Africa, people often remember their first encounter in the field, their first moment. Do you remember that?
Yes.
First arriving with the lily, or the lily of the Kasai?
Yes.
What struck you most?
Well, do you mean when I first arrived, which wasn't with the lily, it was with the nuns in the convent.
Ah.
There was a missionary order, Les Oblats de Marie, who received me, because there was nowhere for me to stay, upriver of the Lele, but they were living in Lele country in Basongo. So that it made sense to take the river boat all the way up to Basongo, get out, be received by the missionaries, and allowed to sleep for a fortnight while I find my feet in their house, and to learn a bit of language, because the Lele didn't speak any French. Oh, yes, there was one who spoke French, but he had a cleft palate.
Mm.
And I said to them later, I couldn't understand him. They said, well, we can't either. That was really hard. And I'm not very good at languages, but they gave me a chance to get to know something about the language, which I had done before in London.
Mm.
I'd gone to a class on Bantu, very good linguist, whose name was again out of my head. Sorry, bad. 5 years earlier, I might be able to tell you.
So that was the first encounter.
So I met these, I thought, extremely handsome, very shy people who tried to talk French to the nuns. Nobody knew Lele. Nobody knew Lele. Lele didn't know French except for this one person. And I was sunk, you see, really, for the beginning. But the lorries of Archebe, Archebe is the Uyuri du Congo Belge, which is Lever Brothers.
Lever Brothers,
who had a palm oil in palm cutting, oil collecting industry right down in Lele country, and the only cash they got was by climbing palm trees and cutting down palm oil nuts and selling them. And the lorries came down, so I was brought down. And I think somebody probably was persuaded to drive me down, but I had some luggage. And so it was about, I can't remember how many miles away, about 50, the first village was about 50 miles away. And I was very struck by the handsomeness of these people and by the tremendous elegance of life and the beauty of their houses, which were made of very beautiful palm rib houses and palm thatched. And the difficulty of speaking to them, you see, above all. But the first village was hopeless for me. It was too near the missionary station, for one thing. And they were terribly impressed. It was too near the district officer's area. And they were terribly impressed by the anxiety that something awful might happen to me, and that like I might fall down and hurt myself, and that they would be blamed and suffer by the administration. So they found me a little cook. I say little, he was half pygmy. Mm. And a very lovely pygmy face, which is quite different from the ordinary Negro face. Mm. This lovely big smile on him. And he couldn't speak English, French or English either. He had a really hard time with me, consequently. I had, you know, we pointed to things, and I began to learn. But he was in charge of me, as it were. And when he, I explained that this was no good, I managed to say, we must go somewhere else. He said, you come to my village. How did I know enough to understand him? I did. We must go to my village and we'll live there. And nobody will stop you from going into the forest. They stopped me. They wouldn't let me go out of the village because they thought a tree would fall on me or I'd stumble. So we took a lorry and went down to his village. And that was quite, quite different. I was accepted as a sort of member of the village because of him. Mm. It was a nice story.
He was very nice.
And missions had built a rest house in the village, which again was a very beautiful big house, bigger than theirs, with a big open door, which had, you know, those blinds that go, Venetian blinds,
yeah.
Kind of Venetian blinds with their windows, European adaptation for windows. For my door. Oh, in the first village and the first night, I'd read all the missionary stuff about them because EP insisted that we should become scholars of the region and we should not just concentrate on our tribe, we should know the whole areas and politics and the rest as well as we possibly could. So I read lots and lots of missionary books about the people around the Lele. There was nothing much about the Lele. But there was a story about somebody in that lake, that was part of the Lake Nyasa training, about somebody who'd had a leopard come into their house in the village and kill them. So the first night there, I heard something snuffling around my open door. You see, it wasn't open, it just had a Venetian blind in front of it and all the windows. And I felt, I was persuaded it was a leopard. And I was terrified. And what happened through the night, I think I got out and called, what's his name? Elias, and he called, and he rose the alarm and called. It was a pig that was snuffling around my house, and all the young men came into my hut and said, any trouble, you know, we're here for you, and we look after you. So I was very charmed by them. When I went back 40 years later, they showed me the spot where I'd seen, thought a pig was a leopard.
Lovely.
Yeah. They were so warm and generous. One of the expressions they gave, which I thought it was curious. We can say when somebody's a village is starving that they shared their last crumb.
Yeah.
But their way of saying that was, she can come with us and we'll all starve together. They're very poetic people.
Mm. What were you specifically thinking you were studying? Was it the total kind of anthropology where
yes.
it was everything?
Yes, it was total anthropology.
Mm.
Yeah. Starting with the shape of the hut, you know, and going on to the
kinship system and everything.
Yes. How they earned their living, how they made their livelihood and everything. Mm. Yeah. Technology.
Yes.
Yeah. I got some nice photographs.
Mm.
With a box camera, because I can't manage but technical things.
Mm. When you how long were you there?
A year the first time, and not nearly long enough, and 4 months the second time.
Mm.
Long back.
Mm.
Probably 3 months, yes.
And then you returned, and do you have a job?
Yes, I had a job immediately at college, at Oxford.
At Oxford?
Mm. I was on the staff there.
As a lecturer?
Yes.
Before you'd even got your PhD?
Let me think. No, I was on a scholarship for the PhD and a job immediately afterwards, yes.
Mm.
Now, how did it happen? I got the PhD after I'd left Oxford. I must have had a job right away.
Mm.
Mm.
Those were the days.
Mm.
And who were your examiners in the PhD?
Nice question. E.P. Ma, I think, yes.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Those, can we dwell on both of those a moment? Because E.P., obviously, you've written a biography of him and he has influenced you hugely.
Mm.
Apart from mentioning that he was a bit tactless as to the choice of your supervisor, what else would you like to say about him?
Yes. He was very rude. He could be very, very rude. But this was to people whom he thought deserved rudeness. You see, he was very rude to Raymond Firth and came and told us how rude he was. And we were embarrassed, you see, that. But to his pupils, he was incredibly courteous. So that, I mean, you don't normally, you know, if I may say so, and I'd venture to suggest that sort of
yes,
language.
Yes, yes.
Which was creepy. It was somebody who was so outright and forthright. So he says, and where are you thinking of publishing your thesis? Yeah. So that's a surprise to people who knew him outside the circle of intimates. But that's how he was with his friends, you see.
Mm. And in comparison to all the other anthropological figures of the 20th century you met, where would you rate his stature?
Ah, have I thought? I haven't thought of this ever before.
Mm-hmm.
So my first quick instinctive answer is first with Levi Strauss, two firsts, in completely changing the subject. I suppose no, with Radcliffe Brown. Radcliffe Brown, E.P., Levi Strauss, and then Godfrey Leonhardt.
Mm.
I thought Leech was a bad influence on anthropology.
We'll come back.
I always feel that Cambridge is a hostile territory, another tribe.
What way do you think Leech was a bad influence?
I have to think harder about that.
We can come back to that.
Yes, I can't remember. I always did think that, but for the moment I'm lost for thinking about it.
We might come back.
I'm caught up in earlier stages, yes.
Let's keep on the earlier stage.
Yeah, if you want to. Mm.
The other two people you mentioned there, one was Maya Fortes.
Mm.
Is there anything about Maya that you particularly remember? Many things, of course. But
yes. No, he was so stimulating and so quick and so generous.
Mm.
Very generous. He was marvellous. He and E.P. were equally as important, one as the other.
Mm.
He was a much shyer personality, but he managed with Frank Steiner and the Bohannans and me. We were a very small group. We were six of us actually in the first year at anthropology department, because there was no undergraduates at that stage. And so it was a very privileged little in-group that started out talking to each other all the time about anthropology. Then Godfrey Leonhardt joined us.
Mm. They were nearly
I'm
all
not prepared African, for this. I should have looked it up a bit. I can't remember.
Mm. They were nearly all Africanists, weren't they?
Yes, yes. Pitt Rivers was there.
Julian.
I just been seeing his wife, Francoise, last week.
Mm.
Julian, yes, and he wanted to go to Italy, and I would like to have gone to Italy or to Greece. I felt I didn't know my own culture. I didn't want to go to Africa at all. And he was got absolutely no support from them for going to Africa, and he had to pay for it out of his family, had to pay for him to go to Spain. And I hadn't any funds. I never would have thought of doing that anyway. But the reason against going out anywhere except Africa was because of the development of theory. There were things that were being discussed and controversies that one could learn from and join and take deeper. And in the Mediterranean area, it was barely starting. It was only honor and shame, and no strong tradition of argument, really. And I think it was right. I'm terribly glad I went to Africa because of the lady. Much the strongest influence on my life.
The lady?
Yeah.
The other person you mentioned there was Godfrey Leonhardt.
Yes, yes.
I knew him a little at the end, but what was he like?
Quizzical, funny, witty, and profound, I think. And I think his book on the Dinka is Dinka religion is the best book on religion, except for Gellner's, from an anthropologist's point of view, until you get to Gellner's Saints of the Atlas. And now I think Whitehouse is really brilliant, Harvey Whitehouse. But I thought that his insight and conscientious care to be close to their thought and not to use words that defaced it was marvellous, a marvellous example.
Why did you leave Oxford and go to UC then?
Because I got married. Yeah, I would never have left otherwise.
And your husband was in the civil service? Or
yes.
Jack, was it? Or
James. What was he doing in 51 when we got married? He had just left the civil service and entered the Conservative Research Department.
So you came to this house, did you then? Or?
Practically. We had, he'd been living in a lovely flat in South Kensington, and we stayed there for the first 5 years. And then with three children, we were really technically overcrowded on any standard because it was a two-bedroom flat. And so we had to move, and we came here nearly 50 years ago.
Yeah. And you went to the Department of Anthropology at UC. Who was there then?
Yes, Phyllis Cabery. Harry Powell was there.
Who worked in the Trobriand.
Yes. Was he there as a student, or was he there as a staff? Both, I think, probably. Yes. And physical anthropology was very important with Barnicot. Peter Morton Williams.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Who's up in North London now.
And Darrell was the chair, was he?
Yes, he was way above everybody else in experience and knowledge and in general scholarship. And his being a geographer first was part of what put him outside the clique of Malinowski students, really. I think his comedy accent helped to put him outside. And I think his and his geography, so he never felt that he was one with them, and they never treated him fairly, except Max Gluckman. He made great friends with Max. That was important to him. He needed that sort of support. It was he and Max, I think, who started the ASA series of books, I think.
After that 1963 conference, wasn't it?
Yes, I've forgotten the dates, yes.
Yes, the big series. What did you mainly teach? What was the...
Yes, they had to stop me from talking all the time about the lady. I taught everything about the lady. I did the first year course. And that was very, very, very stimulating. Because the first year students asked those really zany questions out of the off the board altogether and make you really struggle to make sense of what you were teaching, which second and third year students are much too sophisticated to do. They just, you know, then relate it to other anthropological things, but the first year students really stretch your mind. But I would like to have taught, I would love to have had graduate students, and we could never get them. There were only two graduate students coming to our department a year.
Gosh.
And Daryl took them.
Goodness.
We didn't have Phyllis took some because she had a clever way. She took, for instance, somebody I met recently, again, who is in Sheffield. No, somewhere up north. But mostly her trick with the graduate students was that if they didn't want to do West Africa, they could always go to Australia. She had friends in Australia, who were they? Big Australian anthropologists at...
Elkin and people like that.
Yes. And so consequently, she siphoned off the other ones that I might have had. So in a sense, it was a rivalry, a problem to get any students at all in those days. Now they've got more than they can cope with.
Yes.
But I minded dreadfully not having any graduate students who were really... if they went to West Africa, they had to go to Dal. And I couldn't really do... I had three children. I couldn't really do the kind of fieldwork supervision that they would have got from Dal. And I didn't know the Congo well enough, and then there was a war. In 61 it started.
Yes.
But mind you, I'd been there before that. So I felt deprived in a way, intellectually deprived, and yes, couldn't argue things out. And I gave everybody a copy of Poet in Danger, hoping to get some conversation.
Didn't you get conversation?
No.
Really?
Only from Peter Morton Williams.
This is before it was published, you mean?
After it was published.
After it was published. Well,
that's what I mean by a loss.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm surprised, because that's probably had more conversation around it than almost any book.
But not from anthropologists.
Well, they talk about it and teach it all the time. It's
Do
one.
They?
Oh yes,
yeah.
It's one of our two recommended undergraduate books.
You'd think, and we'd probably want you to cut this out, because it sounds like complaining. You'd think that if that was the case, I would have occasionally been asked to examine PhDs in which my subject was related, but I never was.
Really?
No.
You must have examined PhDs.
One or two.
Really?
In 50 years.
Really? Gosh. Well, I'll swap.
So I think I was off the map.
Well, since you mentioned that wonderful book, which sort of... was like a star across my horizon when I was at the LSE in 1967. Can you?
It only just come out then.
Yes, 1967. It just come out, and I remember Maurice Friedman saying
he was very generous about it.
You know, there is Steiner on taboo. There is Douglas on dirt, as he used to say. How can you explain how you? The moment when you thought you might write a book on that subject.
Yes.
And why?
Yes. I had mumps.
Not everyone who has mumps writes Purity in Danger, but...
Because it was an infectious disease, and I was not to contaminate the children. Or indeed, I got it from the children, but I'm not to contaminate anybody else. So naturally I was reflecting on defilement and contamination. That was the connection.
I see.
That was the immediate connection, and I got quite a long way with it, because I thought of secularizing the idea of ritual purity. That was what the idea was. You want me to go on?
Yes, please.
I can't think. I need your questions.
Well, two obvious influences must have been Durkheim, Sacred and Profane, when you mentioned, and Robertson Smith.
Absolutely, yes. Yes. And Frank Steiner. On taboo.
Yes. And you even make a connection with your own house. And
spring cleaning.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it was partly out of your own lived experience.
Of course, and this experience of hierarchy and of a matter out of place, yes.
Yes.
I'm having it very much in mind at the moment because my sister has come to help me in living here, and she thinks I'm so dirty, my kitchen manners, but I think she's so untidy. My friends laugh and say, well, you had it coming too. So I say to her, I don't believe in germs, but that isn't true. I do believe in germs, but I don't believe in any activity that would be useful against them.
That's an important distinction.
Yes, yes.
And do you think your Catholicism also, because it's clear that in Jewish, you draw on Jewish food taboos.
Oh, yes. Mm.
Do you think that Catholicism, your Catholicism also made you aware of sacred, profane boundaries, which you wanted to discuss?
I can't quite connect it up at the moment. Mm. Perhaps I will later, but I can't for the moment. Mm. I know that there's this chapter on Leviticus in it.
Exactly.
Which I've had to take back since.
Have you? Mm. It was one of the most striking things.
It's the one that made it famous, yes. Yes.
What, in what way have you had to take it back?
I now can criticise Puritan Danger for you, that you'd like me to do that.
Yes.
At the time, I was much too much interested in cognition as something that was supported by behaviour and that reflected behaviour, so that it was a cognition and society with a kind of intellectual backgrounds to Puritan Danger, that the mind gets a lot of discomfort from seeing things that don't fit the categories that people are using for thinking about them.
Yeah.
And this was very Durkheimian and Mosean. And I pushed that idea so far through the book that I left out the main, the central message of the book, which was that social life makes the categories. And so people, at the time when I even concluded the book, and when I read Leviticus, I treated the forbidden foods in Leviticus as cognitive categories.
Mm-hmm. Ways to think, good to think with. Yes.
Good to think with, yes. Which is my great reproach against Levi-Strauss, you see. Mm. Whereas they should have been good for interacting with other people and making an understanding of why we're interacting and what we're doing. And therefore, the action part should have been much more to the fore. It was in the book, but nobody took it up because they liked that chapter, the cognitive one, best. And so the rest of the book got lost in both in my thinking in the book and in people's reading of the book, understandably. Mm. So that it didn't do what it was meant to do, which was to attack and overturn the excessively intellectualist approach to religion, but to turn it into a behavioral intellectualist approach from anthropology, which is much more anthropological, I thought.
Mm. Had this been influenced by Evans Pritchard? Because, as you know, he wrote that famous lecture on attacking the intellectualist.
Well, I think it was through all our teaching. It was all the teaching we got. I mean, through all that we learned at Oxford was about the whole people, the whole tribe, the whole life, the whole economy, all being integrated. Mm. That was not, didn't have to be from that lecture. It wasn't. No, that lecture wasn't particularly good, I don't think.
But it was something we were taught, the holistic approach to.
Absolutely. What they now think they've invented in Oxford. That I went to a conference on Evans Pritchard in Oxford. Mm. No, I went to a conference on anthropology in Oxford. The new thing is holism.
I know. I went to it too.
Oh, you were there?
David Parkin and so on.
Oh, yes, you heard that. You heard holism. Yes. That made me laugh, really. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
After Purity in Danger, what did you then work on?
Well,
that was natural.
I'd like to come back to the Leviticus thing later, perhaps. Yes.
Yeah.
Natural Symbols was a result of criticism from Bernstein, Basil Bernstein, who was a great influence on everything after I read his first article, the first article that I read of his, which was in the Penguin book of sociolinguistics. And I thought he was writing as an anthropologist about behavior and speech together. And he was a real Durkheimian. He lived and breathed and thought Durkheimian things all the time. Mm. Absolute joy to talk to him from Oxford, you see. Mm. And he reproached Puritan Danger for its oversimplification and overemphasis on the universality of the principle of disorder. He said lots of people love disorder and thrive in it, and you haven't allowed for them at all. And he gave this crude example of the artist that he was very interested in art, especially modern art. So he said, what about the artist who's fanatically interested, passionately interested in his picture? And that's where the order is. And everything around him in the studio can be as chaotic as you like, but as long as the palette is how he wants it and the picture, that's all that matters. And as for the plates and saucers in the sink for making, he'll go and pee in it if he hasn't got time. He can't spare the time to go downstairs to the loo. And he reproached me very deeply in those terms for not having paid attention to the people to whom my principle didn't apply. Mm. See? So that's where natural symbols came from. I had to take account of different kinds of cultures, and the cultures that laid a great emphasis on classification, which I regard as the hierarchical ones, because they're classifying each other all the time. And so the classifying is part of their social life, and the social life comes, organizes them to classify all their objects and things that they have around them and other people. And then the opposite end of the opposite, diagonally opposite from the classifiers, were the people whose life was all to make of individuals interacting with other individuals and with an entirely individualist approach to society, which is what we have to fight, I think, as anthropologists in the present very strong methodological individualism, which gives us not a chance. We'd have a much better chance if we could overcome that very strong bias which results from the hegemony of economic theory in the social sciences. Natural symbols?
Yes.
I was very impressed and influenced by Basil Bernstein's own classification of families. He was interested in children's response to education is itself influenced by the system of control that the families used. And he himself allied himself with the working class, so-called, and he, although he wasn't working class in the sense I would use of the word, his father was a furrier. And he thought of the working class as having what he called a positional family, a family in which everybody had a position and you just stayed in your position. I call it a hierarchical family, and I think positional, I'm moving now to calling the whole thing positional. positional family, you go to bed according to your position in the family, first if you're youngest, second if you're next youngest, and you have your seat at the table, that's your position, and that depends also on gender and age, and everything is done according to work is assigned in the family for cleaning the car or mowing the lawn or scrubbing the doorstep. So women do some things and boys do other things. And I adjusted that to my interest in culture. He had a 2x2 model of it, so he called them weak classification, strong classification. The middle class striving, as he always said insultingly of the middle class, striving middle class, had weak positional system, weak authority. It was all personal. It wasn't on positions. Do it because I said so, and do it because I ask you. Not because I said so, that's authority, but because I ask you. Why should I be quiet when the mother says be quiet? Dad is trying to sleep, but that doesn't matter. Well, yes, he'd wake up, he'd be sad, Great play on feelings and emotions in the middle classes as a system of control. So I thought that was so neat, and I adjusted that. For him, the children who'd been brought up on the personal system were lost when they got to school because they were expecting personal emotions, and they found in fact that it was positions when they got to school and performance according to position. And I thought it was very rich and powerful analysis, and I adjusted it for kinds of religions and for kinds of societies that can produce the kind of religion, and that was the basis of natural symbols. So that I had positional religions belonging to positional societies. So on.
Yes, I remember. What was the bit about the bog Irish?
That would be positional. The Irish had a very positional idea about religion generally.
Mm.
And therefore, I think it fits well with a rather static economy, where striving won't do you any good anyway.
How is it different from the famous distinction between status and contract?
Not very. Not very at all. Except that it's got four corners except two, instead of two. The two corners that status and contract makes up, leave out, are the ones in which, as a group separates itself from the mainstream. Or an individual can be separated from the mainstream, probably without wishing to. And those give you the sectarian, what I call enclave culture, which is very distinctive and very worth studying, especially in connection with terrorism.
Mm.
And the individualist, the private individuals who are more and more alone, the more the economy becomes one in which you can work at home and not have anything to do with anybody else.
Mm. So, when was it that you retired, or at least went to America? Because...
Yes, 1976. 77.
Yeah, you were still pretty young, weren't you? I mean, it wasn't retirement, really.
I had a job. I was invited to...
The Russell Sage.
Russell Sage Foundation, yes, that's right.
Why did you do that, do you think?
Because my friend invited me, and Jim was ready to leave here, England, at that point. And I'd been 27 years in one place. I needed a change.
Hmm.
I also hoped to get graduate students.
Hmm. Did you?
I had didn't have long in the research because the friend who invited me to go and join his team, his new team, he was just starting it, got the sack within 3 months. So that didn't work very well. I stayed on, finished the year.
That was Wildowski or whatever.
Wildowski, yes.
Wildowski.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you enjoy America?
Yes, I loved it. I'm very glad I did it.
Hmm.
We stayed there 11 years. Yeah.
What was it about?
I tried to come back, but couldn't get a job because Mrs. Thatcher started to cut down on universities.
Hmm.
Universities started to cut down.
Hmm.
I didn't stay in that job, obviously, because it disappeared. I taught in Northwestern, and I taught in Princeton.
Hmm.
That was it.
Hmm.
In Northwestern, I was in the religion department, which was a pity because I just got interested in risk. And I was working on risk while they were working on religion. I wasn't really taking advantage of my surroundings.
Mm.
But it was from there that I got an invitation to give the Gifford Lectures on natural religion. And 3 years' warning. If you ever do something with 3 years' warning, you realize it's much too much. You don't know what, get into a real tizzy about an important thing you've got to do in 3 years. So I started somebody had a chance to ask me to come and talk to her students about the anthropology of sacrifice. Her students were the Princeton Theological Seminary. And so I went, found that they all knew much more about it than I did. And it was, what I said was very naive and simple compared with what the Bible scholars knew. As I started to read the Bible, she asked me to take a section from the Book of Numbers and explain it to them. But they all understood much better than I did. And I was totally mystified by the Book of Numbers and decided that I would give the Book of Numbers the basis, make it the basis for my Gifford Lectures. And that's what started me on my present work.
I see. Well, just to backtrack a tiny bit, why did you get interested in risk? I mean, it's a very fashionable subject now.
Yes, Aaron. Aaron, is it still fashionable? At that
stage, it
was absolutely on top of the world. It was really fashionable then.
It's really fashionable now, too.
Is it?
Well, risk aversion and risk, you know, all the terrorism and all the...
Of course, it should be.
Mm.
Well, at that time, Aaron read one of my articles and asked me to join him because of that.
Mm.
It was the one about the environments at risk.
Mm.
And I wasn't thinking of risk as a subject. But when I got there to work with him, we both found that the whole field was dominated by a psychometric theory of aversion, which is entirely individualist. There's absolutely no room for cultural pressures, for people, for sharing points of view, or for sharing risks. It was completely unreal, I think.
Mm.
Unreal in the fullest sense. And so we set up together, and with his help, I wrote Risk and Culture, which he tried to integrate the recognized problems about a theory of risk into a cultural framework of kinds of risk takers, and that's the book we wrote, Risk and Culture.
Mm.
And after that, I think we won. I think people really took account of the social aspects of risk taking. Although it was a very hard struggle against the individualist position.
Mm.
A But just to know what an individual is enough. You don't need to know anything else according to this position. But we were trying to insist on trying to understand varieties of cultures and how cultures depend on social forms and how social forms are largely a matter of our will, our wish to collaborate this way or that, and of permitting circumstances.
Yeah, and that's fine. Then you worked on consumption with Baron Isherwood.
That was before.
Well, it was before. Really.
Before I went to, well, I took the World of Goods with me when I went to America, and that was fulfilling a long-term ambition. I really wanted to understand. I thought that the economists working on money, would, and really from a sort of Keynesian background, would have wonderful formulae with summarizing theories about cultural movements, culturally held, shared ideas. But they didn't really. But I enjoyed studying it. It was a long felt wish to study economics. And Baron was great.
I've always wondered whether he was a baron or whether that was his Christian name.
His Christian name.
His Christian name.
Let's call it his first name.
His first name, yes. Fine. So, what was it about America that you liked most at that time, do you think? It was just the optimism, or the resources, or the people, or what?
Obviously, it was the people I met, and the warmth. I think I particularly liked the women's culture. In English academics life, there isn't a women's culture. At least there wasn't then. There might be now. But in America, they'd started having women's academic associations. There was one called NOW in Northwestern. What did it stand for? National something women. I can't remember. Anyway, the women were much more supportive of each other and friendly, and it was very delightful. That's what I think I particularly liked. Compared with people that we've been interviewing in academic life here.
And then when you came back, you didn't come back to another teaching job in...
No, I was too old. I was, it was 88 when we came back.
Yes.
So how old was I? 1921?
1921. Yes, 67, the time of
yes,
retirement.
Yes, it's past retirement, yes. Yes, that was after, I'd already spent 3 years in Princeton. That was a great joy. I really enjoyed Princeton better than anything else. I was back there last month.
Did you?
No, December.
Has it changed?
Since December, since I was there before?
Yes.
Not that I could see. The same old friends were there too.
And then you mentioned you started to work on the Book of Numbers. And
yes, that was the Gifford Lecture. And I really had a nerve to do that and give the lecture on it. I wanted to read it as an anthropologist. And in the end, I did write the book of the lecture called In the Wilderness. But at the time, I hadn't, and it was a very June sort of simple lecture about Moses and Miriam and Aaron. I think it must have been terribly boring. I'm glad there's no record of it. But Graham Auld, who was the host for the Gifford Lectures that year, who was at the Divinity School in Edinburgh, came out to me afterwards, very courteous and hospitable host. Chivalrous, I would say, more than courteous, because this is what happened. He said, have you read any, I just wondered hearing you reading from the text, have you read any of the commentaries on the Book of Numbers? I hadn't. So in a haughty way, sort of anthropological arrogance, I said, no, in anthropology we prefer to read the primary text first. Well, it's the most absurd thing you could ever imagine to say, because there's no primary text in the Bible. There's hundreds of texts. And there's millions of commentaries, and how to do it without reading them. It's quite crazy, and a real cheek on my part to do it at all, especially to answer him like that. But we remained friends. It's amazing. And then I got so interested in it afterwards, when I began to read the commentaries and found that they dismissed it. Most of the commentaries said it was badly constructed, a mess. Junk room of the Bible is what Bellhausen said. And I was so indignant, because anthropologists can't dismiss their sources like that. We have to take the source as it is, very, very seriously. And so then I found that, so far from being disorderly, it was a brilliantly conceived and executed ring composition. That's to say, a chiastic structure. Does that make sense?
Chiastic.
Yes, means A, B, C, B, A. Mm. As if it was a poem that you were giving the last rhyme lines for. But it's a ring is a ring because it goes back to the beginning. And then it has problems in making it the mid-turn. All the meanings are tucked into the mid-turn. And the rest of it, the book, as it were, seems when it's finished to spring out from the mid-term rather than go to the end. Mm. But if you read it in a linear fashion, as if the whole thing was a line, like our writing, our modern writing, you don't realize that it's all in the middle and you generally miss the meaning. So I've had a lot of fun ever since studying that form and showing how they've been misread.
Mm. And do biblical scholars take it seriously now?
They've always taken it seriously because they thought that they've always taken that subject seriously. But mostly it's been done so lightly and so, I think, almost frivolously, lightheartedly, without expecting the meaning to be different. And mine hasn't had much chance. Nobody reads the Book of Numbers anyway because of its bad reputation. So my book hasn't really made much waves. Nobody's said much about it. But then I applied it to Leviticus. And Leviticus has much, much more interesting, wonderful structure. Have I got time to tell you?
Yes, do.
It's not my door. Leviticus is a picture poem. That's to say that it's not a ring in the strict sense of a fully developed ring with a middle and A, B, C, D, E, D, C, B, A structure. But it's got a three-part structure, and I don't know how I got to it, but the whole thing is modelled on the temple, on the tabernacle, which has got a big open court at the beginning, where everybody must bring their private sacrifices, and then there's a story, all the rest of its laws, a short and rather sinister, bad story about sons of Aaron being killed because they insulted the tabernacle. And then you go through that as if it was a door, if you were thinking of the level of the building instead of the level of the book. And then you've got an entrance to the priest's sanctuary, where the priests have all their business, and they don't live there, but they eat there and they worship there. But they've got, it's a priest's corner, where nobody but priests are allowed to go in. And then the next one, there's another story, another equally punitive story, very short. And then you're into the Holy of Holies, which is tiny. So it goes from a large place to a small place to a tiny place. And the culmination is the covenant, which is kept in the Holy of Holies. And only the high priest can go there. So there's restricted entry at three levels. And so then you look at the book and realize that it's a, and you have other clues for thinking it's the same as the same structure, the same proportions as the tabernacle. You realize that the first part, which is a ring, is very, very large. It's all about sacrifice. It's about individual sacrifice. When and why an individual and how can make a sacrifice to God. The second part is all about the priests, what they can eat, what they can do, who they can marry, and the sacrifices they've got to perform for public purposes, public sacrifices. It goes through the last door and it's all about the covenant. The word covenant keeps coming up. It's very, very small, three little tiny sections, chapters. And it's the place where the covenant is kept is honoured in this book of Leviticus by the description of the covenant. So it's a very elaborate literary style, and it's called a picture poem where it's repeated elsewhere. You know about the picture poems? Very fashionable in England in the 17th century.
Possibly through Francis Yates's work on the art of memory.
She's so important for me, yes, absolutely. You think of a house in her book, and this is exactly like the tabernacle one, and you go into it, you're making a speech, you're a student of Cicero, and you're making a speech, and you have to think of it, the first part of it is like going up the stairs to the main hall, and then you turn to the right and you go into a room there, and that's the second part of your speech. The third part is you turn to the left and go into the other room, and that's the third part of your speech, and then you come down the stairs again, the way you came up, so you repeat the section. It's wonderful. And that's very important for me in description of it. The picture poems you take are very important in 4th century Greek literature. Little poems, a pipe, an altar, a bird with open wings, a lute to play on, or a flute. And you make your poems so that each line is cut so that visually on the page, by the time you've cut the lines, you've got a silhouette of the thing your poem's about. So it's reaching you at two levels, visual and verbal. And this was very, very popular. Herbert did a lot of it.
Yes, the famous dove.
Easter wings.
Yes, Easter wings.
And so Leviticus was an early one of those. Yeah, very early.
That sounds fascinating. I interviewed Jonathan Bentall recently, and he was enthusing about your work on Leviticus and saying how fascinating it was. I suppose
how nice of him.
The question really is, rather like Levi-Strauss's interpretation of myth, how would you know whether you were right?
Yeah.
Except on aesthetic grounds.
How objective can it be? Yes, very. Very objective. For instance, the Book of Numbers. The system has one in which the words have to be repeated on both sides of the divide. The poem is divided in half, or the book. And the middle and the first part must correspond to each other. Correspond in saying, using the same words very often and repeating the theme, so that in Leviticus it's all about how the first beginning part is about how the Levites are going to revolt. In the middle they revolt. And they're punished and as was threatened. So the correspondence is very, very strong and it must stand out. Nobody could deny that, you see. But the words also are objectively checkable. This is how I got to it, really. When I heard about it and thought that this might be the structure of numbers, have you got time to get this? I noticed this part about the beginning of numbers. The Levites are going to revolt and look out for them. They'll be killed. They will die. And then I got to chapter. What I found was, it's strictly divided into legal parts and narrative parts. So it's law, story, story. And the story parts go on round consecutively, so that it's the people of Israel, they set out, they go first, and then they go next, and then they arrive, and then they arrive finally, and they get back to the River Jordan and their home. And so that's the story parts, but the legal parts seem to interrupt them, and that's where it got its reputation for being so disorderly. And people have tried the idea that the law parts are related to the story parts, but they're not. They don't belong there. The law parts are the structure. And the ways of telling whether you're into a law part or a story part are objective. I can give them to you, but I got a Hebrew Bible scholar to do it for me, following my instincts, and he found that they were much strongly marked than I thought. The very ones I thought were very, very strongly marked. Want to hear how? Yeah, you do? Every story starts with a name of a people or persons, like Moses said, or Moses did, or the people of Israel. And it starts with a place, when they got to this particular place, at this place, Moses said, and it's got a time. In the seventh day or the 12th month or something. So that all the stories located immediately. And then the story develops a plot and has an ending, little story. But the laws have nothing like that. They're forever, you see. And they start with the Lord said to Moses, do this and do that. It's just a law. There's no doubt about it. And the markings are much stronger than I had thought they would be, if you know Hebrew. Because they're poetic structures as well. So when I found the beginning and the middle were strong correspondence like that, I thought, well, why 12 sections? There's 12. Is it the zodiac? Is it the year? What is it? Why 12? Why is it of the 12 sons of Jacob? What is it? And somebody sent me this thing about the Sephirot, which are the big universal principles that underlie the whole mystic universe in Hebrew mythology. And the 12 of them are related to the months of the year. So I thought, right, well, if this is the beginning of the year, and Jewish custom has two new years, so the seventh section, I'm counting my sections, you see, the seventh and the first correspond like this. What happens to the equinoxes? See, so that would be section 3 and section 11, 10, section 4 and section 10. Laws. So the first ones are stories, but the cross sections, middle ones, are laws. And it said, so I read it anxiously to see if there's any correspondence, and it starts out very short, and it says, "The Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron and his sons to make two silver trumpets and to blow them, and you shall blow them on all your assemblies and for all wars, and you shall blow them twice for disc and for alarms, and on the seventh month you shall blow them on this day of the seventh month." So I go anxiously across to number 10, and it says, oh no, sorry, I left out the crucial word. You should blow them on the seventh month, and you should blow them for all your appointed feasts. So you go across, and it says, these are your appointed feasts. I just had goose flesh when I saw that. And then it tells you, at the end of that section, it says, and you should blow your trumpets on the seventh month, seventh day, seventh month. So that kind of evidence, somebody can gainsay it. People have quarreled by saying, look, the word trumpet is different in the two cases, but the word blow isn't. And so on. So that started me on this, that I'm still on. My book that's in press now is on ring conversation.
What is it called?
It's called Thinking in Circles.
Thinking in Circles. Mm-hmm. Lovely. Well, thank you for giving us a prelude to it. It looks fascinating. Is there anything that you feel we should have touched on and we haven't?
No, I don't think so. I think you've been very good. You covered everything.
The only person you mentioned as being, you mentioned Godfrey E.P. on religion, and then you mentioned Ernest Gellner's.
And Steiner.
Mm. Did you know Ernest?
Yes.
How did you get on with
him? I didn't get on very well in the sense that we never saw each other very much. Mm. But I always admired him very greatly. I was sorry he went off into nationalism, because that was so vague compared with his brilliant fieldwork.
Good. Well, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
For a fascinating interview.
Thank you, Mary, for giving me the chance to let off all that steam.
Lovely.